Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When I came 12 years ago, we didn't have enough funding to be able to buy food for all the kids' programs. So it was what we could glean out of what was donated that we didn't need for dinner. And that's what they would provide kids.
Vicki Pierce of the Community Kitchen of Monroe County talks about what they now serve to kids and other changes her organization has made over her tenure. When it's hot and humid, there are few things more refreshing than a cold drink. Daniel Orr blends up some watermelon mint and a whole lot of ice. While women are close to or more than half of students at state ag colleges all over the Midwest, you're likely to find it's the men planning to head straight back to the farm after college. That's from Harvest Public Media. And not your grandparents' 4-H. We visit county fairs to hear how the ag organization is getting hip to the times. Headlines from the week. Here's Mark.
McDonald's announced it will be removing some artificial ingredients from its menu items. The fast food giant will replace the high fructose corn syrup in its buns with sugar, and Chicken McNuggets will no longer contain artificial preservatives. Last year, McDonald's announced it was phasing out the use of some antibiotics in chicken it serves. Meanwhile, poultry producer Sanderson Farms is defending its use of antibiotics with a new ad campaign. In a press release, CEO Joe F. Sanderson Jr. said the company wants to, quote, expose marketing gimmicks and inform consumers about misleading labels that tout antibiotic-free birds. The company's new The Truth About Chicken ads feature two farmers discussing the labels, claiming that labels like raised without antibiotics are misleading because the FDA requires all chickens to be clear of antibiotics before slaughter. Health officials' concerns, however, focus on consumers' exposure to resistant bacteria, not residual antibiotics. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimated in a 2013 report that at least 23,000 Americans die from antibiotic-resistant bacteria each year, and 2 million more become ill. And grocery taxes exist in 16 states. A new report suggests that tax is a source of financial pressure for low-income people. The three states with the highest level of food insecurity are Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama. All three states have a grocery tax, with the taxes in Mississippi and Alabama equal to their relative sales taxes. The new study also examines the differential impact on the grocery tax on those who participate in the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program and those who do not, since food purchased using SNAP benefits is tax-free. The researchers found that grocery taxes had a positive impact on increasing the probability of non-SNAP participants being food insecure. Based on these results, the study suggests that besides eliminating the food tax, targeting households that are eligible for but not currently participating in the SNAP program is the best way to reduce food insecurity in states with a grocery tax. And more stories on our website, one about how craft breweries are boosting hop farmers' bottom lines. That's at eartheats.org.
And there's always Twitter, too, at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla with the news. Thanks.
Glad to do it.
Rural life used to be centered around the farm, but farms don't work like they used to. That's caused a drop in jobs and left some small towns struggling for survival. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
The town of Brookfield, Missouri, in the north central part of the state, is a close-knit community. Population, about 4,500. As Becky Cleveland walks down Main Street, she can see the remnants of the town she grew up in.
When I was a kid, like I said, there was four grocery stores.
Now there's one and a Walmart. Some of the buildings downtown are empty and some are new businesses.
That building burnt, now it's a parking lot. And this building was rebuilt and it was a drugstore. And that was a bakery on the corner.
Cleveland's job is to make sure Brookfield stays on the map by preserving the current businesses there and adding more. Historically, the town's top money makers were agriculture, transportation, and manufacturing. Those still exist today, but each of those industries has taken a hit. The town lost an auto plant, the railroad is less vibrant, and farming just isn't bringing as much to the town as it used to.
We in rural areas have had to try to reinvent ourselves to stay viable and sustainable.
Brookfield's story is a familiar one for thousands of towns across rural America where farmers were once an economic force. It comes down to technology. Thanks to advances like herbicide-resistant seeds and more efficient tractors, farms need fewer employees. Rural towns lost more than 1 in 10 farm jobs over the last decade, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
What does that mean for a rural community?
Mary Hendrickson, a rural sociologist at the University of Missouri, says there's a ripple effect.
How are you going to sell insurance if those people aren't there? How are you going to have a bank if those people aren't there? How are you going to have a grocery store?
Pair that with young people fleeing to cities, Hendrickson says, and you have small towns fading away.
You know, these things just kind of work in tandem. And so then we have to ask a lot of questions about what's the future of rural development for these farming-dependent counties.
Pat Curry with University of Missouri Extension is trying to help rural towns answer that question.
It's going out there and trying to get people to realize that you need that diversified economy, because in those counties where agriculture is dominant right now, it's just going to take a couple of bad years.
Curry says towns need to diversify their economic options. That way, the economy stays somewhat protected if one of those industries takes a hit. In some of the most productive farming counties in the Midwest, agriculture isn't even the biggest industry, Curry says. Why?
Well, it's because they have other things going on. You know, their economy includes manufacturing industries. They may have a prison, because there are a lot of jobs there at that prison, you know, as many as 500 or 600 jobs.
He says rural towns have assets like a ready workforce or a central location or affordable land. They have to sell all kinds of businesses on relocating. Brookfield is betting its economic survival on teaming up with neighboring towns. They want to entice new factories and draw tourists to what they've dubbed the American Genius Highway, where Walt Disney and Mark Twain grew up, and foster entrepreneurship.
Hello. Hey, how are you?
Becky Cleveland pops into a new cafe on Main Street. She often gets coffee here in the morning. Christy and Drew Harper own the shop. They moved from Seattle to buy some land and grow their own food for their family. They see their shop as adding a little Pacific Northwest to rural Missouri.
Create a little bistro, a little place where we can do art, we can do live music on Thursdays and Fridays, and we can feed our family, and then we can feed Brookfield.
One or two people trickle into the cafe during lunch on the day I visited. Christy tells Cleveland they might close up early and head to a town down the road.
I mean, for us it's crazy because we are not used to this small of a town. When there's an event in a town 10 miles away, everyone for 100 miles is there.
Like many new business owners, the Harpers are still ironing out the kinks, with the hope that Brookfield is the right place to settle in. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Vicki Pierce has been the executive director of the Community Kitchen of Monroe County since 2004. On her watch, the organization moved into a larger facility. It expanded outreach programs to kids and seniors, and the Community Kitchen also developed a signature fundraising event, the Chef's Challenge, an event that this year is expected to bring in up to $30,000. I invited Pierce into the Earth Eats studios to reflect on her 12 years of service. So let's think 12 years ago. Paint a picture for me of the food needs of our community then.
Then we were looking at, in terms of the kitchen especially, we were looking at mostly adults, middle adults who either were difficult to employ, let's say that, either because they had physical or mental issues that made it difficult for them to maintain employment or to get employment, or they were folks who just had been transient enough and just, you know, really were having trouble getting a job. And then a significant number of seniors, and then the recession hit. And so then everything changed. And we saw more and more folks who really had previously been employable who weren't. Who couldn't find jobs, and if they could, especially in a community like Bloomington, which is saturated with intelligent, able-bodied people because of the university, unable to get jobs other than maybe minimum wage jobs. And so we saw a lot of folks for the first time who needed services for the first time in their lives. But the big change for us was starting to see more families with kids in the dining room daily. 12 years ago when I started, almost never saw children in the dining room at dinner time. Over the years, that's kind of started to get a little better, but now it's still unusual to not see kids at some point during the evening.
Talking about the uptick in people needing services from the community kitchen, on the one hand, we want the numbers of food insecurity in the state to go down.
Yes.
On the other hand, when we see more people in your kitchen, that means they're aware of your services and they're getting food that they need. How do you reconcile this tension?
So for us, what we really pay attention to are the percentage of our population that we're serving who are the most vulnerable populations. So we track ages and situations of folks as best we can. When we realize, when we continue to see that we're serving high percentages of children, seniors, people who are chronically ill, then we're happy about that. And so the folks in the middle who some of them are able to work and able to make ends meet, we see them only in our dining room. And so for right now, actually for this year in 2016, the meals that we're serving at our main location in Rogers Street on site, those meals are down from last year, which for us, we just assume to mean, because we can't know for sure, we assume to mean are doing better and they're taking care of themselves in some other way. Our numbers are still up significantly for this year, but it's because of our outreach programs to those pockets of folks that might be slipping through the cracks.
Tell me why kids are so affected by food issues, food insecurity.
Well, having two kids who are almost 11 myself, I can, you know, speak from experience. They eat constantly. and that's what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be getting exercise. They're supposed to be growing. Their bodies are growing and developing. And ideally, they're getting fed all the right things, right? They're getting the proteins and the grains and the fruits and vegetables that they need to get the nutrition that's most important and most valuable to them. But what happens when the family doesn't have enough money for food is that even if the parents sort of stop eating to feed the kids, if you've been to the grocery store on a limited budget ever, you know that it's more expensive to buy fresh fruits and vegetables. It's cheaper to buy them ultra-processed in the can with too much sodium and too much sugar. It's also cheaper to buy a lot of carbs and a lot of empty calories. Unfortunately, when that's the way they eat, the hidden effects of that are that they're not as able to focus in school. They're not learning as well, maybe their grades slip a little bit. And if you have several years of that, then you have stunted their potential at that point.
I wonder if the food that you're calling healthy,
yes,
that you serve at the kitchen has changed over the past decade as our understanding of what is and isn't healthy has also changed.
A little bit. I will say what we have served at dinner time in our main dinner meal has always really been pretty consistent. When I came 12 years ago, they were already serving a vegetarian option in addition to the main entree, which almost always has meat. The staff, when I got there, were already very conscious about sodium levels and about sugar in foods because they know a lot of our patrons may be diabetic. What has changed drastically for us is the way that we feed kids. When I came 12 years ago, they were doing the best they could, but we didn't have enough funding to be able to buy food for all the kids programs. So it was what we could glean out of what was donated that we didn't need for dinner, and that's what they would provide kids. And so sometimes it was unfortunately chips or cookies or, you know, or Capri Sun, which is 10% juice. And so, you know, I remember one of the first changes we made, I think my second year there, is I said, no more 10% juice. Like, we're at least going 100% juice. You know, that's one step. And so over the years, we've gotten to where now when we provide lunches to kids this summer, they're getting a healthy wrap or sandwich. So it's like a whole grain wrap with, you know, maybe it's ham or turkey, which may not be, you know, it's processed. It's not the most stellar, but it'll have real cheese with it. And sometimes it'll have vegetable on it as well. And then they may be getting sugar snap peas or carrots or celery or broccoli. And then they're also getting a fruit. So it could be oranges, apples, bananas, pears, grapes, other berries. And so making sure that at least in the way that we feed kids, we're hopefully having a positive impact on the way they see eating in the future.
Let's say you're in this job for another 10 years.
It could happen.
Maybe.
I like my job.
What's your goal 10 years from now?
My first goal for the next 10 years is to have the mortgage paid off. So we moved into our new facility in 2011. It was a $1.4 million project, and we only owe about $225,000 on the building. That's another $2,200 a month that we could put back into program. That's another 1,100 meals a month that we could provide with no additional expense.
Okay, I have to ask you one more thing. Yes. Several years ago, you said that onions were the number one food item that you used the most often and needed the most of.
Yes.
Still true?
That's still fairly true. When gas prices soared several years ago, onions doubled in price, almost quadrupled in price, and never went back down. We had, at that point, we were buying 50 pounds of onions at a time to use. And after that, we stopped. I was like, no, this is too expensive. You don't have to put onions in everything. and so they still use them the most. So that, I, you know, honestly, any kind of vegetables are the thing that we're lowest on. Fresh, canned, frozen, whatever. We'll take them whichever way they come.
Vicki Pierce, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Executive Director of the Community Kitchen of Monroe County. There's a longer cut of my conversation with Vicki Pierce and lots of links to follow at eartheats.org. Coming up with Chef Daniel Orr, a watermelon puree for these hot summer days. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. You're tuned to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. It's fair season in Indiana. That means a lot of 4-H activities happening around the state, but they might not be the ones you're picturing. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek has the story.
I'm Maddie Gerald.
I'm Haley Drake.
Meet the stars of the Clay County Robotics Team.
I'm in 8th grade now.
I'm going to be in 7th grade.
Gerald and Drake are showing off a 3D balsa wood frame they built from scratch. It uses water pumped through tubes to make a wooden clamp lift a block onto a platform.
The water gives it more stability whenever it's raised up.
Okay, so open.
This one makes it move forward.
Oh, let me set it up.
It takes a few tries to make it work, but the team is pretty worn out. They've been out in the hot sun all afternoon. That's because they're displaying their project at the Clay County 4-H Fair. They say it's changed a lot since they were younger.
Yeah, a lot more other things besides animals.
Yeah, before it was all about showing animals. Now it's kind of ventured out
into more activities focused on science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM. State 4-H lead Renee McKee at Purdue University Extension says they've come a long way from their agricultural roots.
The 4-H program actually started because the universities wanted to teach corn production in new and different ways. And when you can't get the adults to pay attention, you give the grains of corn to their children, and let's see who can grow the best corn. So we'll never move away from ag. But what that looks like in the future is far different.
4-H enrollment increased last year after a dip McKee says was caused by a small new annual fee. She says she hopes more STEM projects will keep that number going up. And no matter the activity, she says they'll always have a home at the fair.
The fair is more about fabric of community than it is solely about agriculture. Those people live and breathe for those fairs. Families travel home in the summer to go back to the fair that they experienced as a young person.
50 miles away at the much larger Hendricks County Fair, Brad Goodwin and his wife and kids are doing just that, checking out the 4-H cows across from food carts and a big carnival. Goodwin grew up raising 4-H sheep and cattle. Now he works in advertising and lives in Avon.
But it's always been important to bring the kids out to see the animals. They love animals. So we definitely want them to see that. And we talk about, you know, what I did as a kid.
Nearby, grain farmer David Brock is showing two sleepy Angus cattle with his son Andy, who's helped his father out as technology has gotten more important on the farm. These days, Brock says his son couldn't afford to become a traditional farmer even if he wanted to. But he says,
there's plenty of opportunities for them to be in the agriculture sector and make an awful good living. You know, learn the science of things and you know, then turn around and help us do what we're trying to do with new technology.
For other 4-H alumni, like 20-year-old Maddie Hayden, agriculture isn't in the cards. She used to drive into the country from suburban Plainfield to raise 4-H pigs. Now she's studying speech therapy at Purdue and calls 4-H the best thing she's ever done.
Coming to the fair and learning about agriculture or even being involved in it really teaches you another side of things.
Hayden's back at the Hendricks County Fair for the Celebrity Goat Milking Contest. She was their fair queen last year and the first to claim the state crown. Hayden's doing her best, but one wrong move and this patient mama goat will literally kick the bucket, sending milk flying everywhere. As for the robots, 4-H has those programs in 70 of 92 counties now. Though it won't replace the goats, they expect that number to rise. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Danville.
This story comes from IPB News, Indiana Public Broadcasting's statewide network. Now to Iowa. With all kinds of high-tech machinery and scientific advances, working on a farm has changed significantly over the past several decades. But one tradition remains pretty strong. It tends to be the sons who take over the family farm. Gradually, though, even that is changing. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer tells us more.
Growing up on a family farm in West Bend, Iowa, Haley Banwart and her brother were like other farm kids. They did chores and even raised cattle together.
My brother and I have had the same amount of responsibilities. I can drive a tractor, I can bale square hay, but it was just expected that my brother would return home.
She says they never discussed it. She just accepted that she'd find a different path.
I think it was always kind of the unwritten rule that my brother would go back and farm.
The 2012 Census of Agriculture counted women as nearly a third of the nation's farmers. Some start small vegetable operations. Some work on big commercial farms. Others do the books for their husbands. And all are more likely to raise their hands and be counted as farmers than women of generations past. Madeline Schultz offers her family as an example, beginning with her mother.
My mom milked the cows. She ran the tractor. She did the paperwork. She did all these things, but she didn't call herself a farmer. She was a farmer's wife. And she didn't make the decisions.
Schultz says she and her sisters also deferred farm or business decisions to their husbands. But now, Schultz runs the Women in Agriculture program at Iowa State Extension, which offers farm management classes specifically for women. She says agriculture may be slower, but it is following national trends of women entering traditionally male domains. Her 30-year-old daughter is a farmer.
My daughter graduates from Iowa State University, heads back to the family farm, and just assumes that she is a decision maker.
Today, granddaughter is poised to buy the dairy farm from her grandparents. Women are close to or more than half of students at state ag colleges all over the Midwest, in Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, and Colorado. Still, talk to students on campus, and you're likely to find it's the men planning to head straight back to the farm after college. Virginia Hansen teaches ag communications at Iowa State. For one assignment, her students make films about their farm lives.
The stories that the male students produce show a lot of continuity. They have worked side by side, often with their fathers or grandfathers on the farm.
She says they come to college knowing they are expected to be the next generation on the farm. The women have different stories.
Their films show the same passion for agriculture, the same love of their family farm, the same regard for their parents, and the same just, infectious enthusiasm they have for growing up on a farm in Iowa. But they are unsure about where they're headed.
Do you have any female students who have come in and said, I'm going back to the farm to farm with my dad and my grandpa?
I don't.
And we actually can't go in the hog barn since, they aren't our own.
One of Hansen's recent students, Taryn Riediger, is showing me around a farm that Iowa State students operate as a class. The oldest of seven kids, she grew up among the family's various farm operations.
My Uncle Clay lives on the cattle farm with his wife and kids. My Uncle Corey works and takes care of the sow unit with his
Riediger will graduate in December and wants to farm, but she won't go back home right away.
there's not exactly, a spot specifically for me, at least right now, to go back, and be part of the farm. I mean, of course, they're always going to need help.
Riediger is confident it's the farm's smaller size and not her gender that's preventing her from returning now. She's hoping someday she'll be able to farm full time.
I would love the opportunity to, but my plans as of right now is to do livestock production, for someone else.
Many young women in ag say they hope to farm and raise children. Those farm kids will grow up in a different world with different gender expectations. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
It's a good idea to bookmark the Harvest website. They post lots of wonderful articles and audio stories. Find them at harvestpublicmedia.org. Have you started seeing watermelons at your market yet? It's about that time. Buying melons directly from the farmer is so much better than having to do all those goofy ripeness tests at the grocery store. Daniel Orr, big watermelon fan, he's got a simple juice recipe for us.
So today we're using a little local watermelon. And what I'm going to do is I cut off the top and the bottom, and that way it sits stable. And then I'm going to take the peel off of it. And you just kind of follow the line. You follow right along that melon rind. And you can use the melon rind for pickling. Back in the day when they didn't have a whole lot to eat during the war and between the wars, World War I, World War II, people made do with what they had. And watermelon rinds were a favorite to have alongside cold cuts and smoked fresh local ham and that kind of thing. And what you would do is take the rind, take the peel off of it, so you're just using the white part, and then pickle it with some sugar and spices, and then you could store it, you could can it.
Yeah, so it's a sweet preparation.
Right, exactly. So now you have your nude watermelon, and the seeds do grow in a circle. So if you cut that in half, you can see there's a nice center part that has no seeds. So go ahead and cut that out in a circle. And then you can just take your knife and get rid of all the little seeds. And I think that the watermelons with seeds actually taste a lot better than the seedless varieties. And I know a lot of people love the simplicity and ease of the seedless varieties, but they just aren't quite as sweet. All right, so we've got these nice and seeded, and we're going to puree this. And if you want to, you could add a little bit of water to get the engine going. So we'll just put a little splash in here. And we're going to whiz it around. All right, easy as that. Now what we're going to do, just to make it a little more fun, is put some fresh herbs in it. So we're going to use some mint. And we're just going to chiffonade it, which means that we're going to cut it into thin little ribbons. Okay, and then I've got some frozen glasses. What we're going to do is put the mint leaves in first. So when we pour the melon puree over the top, it will mix in. You could, if you wanted to, you could rim the glass with a little bit of salt like you would a margarita. And that's all there is to it. So I hope you guys go out there and get those local melons and enjoy them in this simple preparation.
Cheers.
Cheers. Here's to Earth Eats.
EarthEats.org is where you can find this recipe along with a recipe for cold cantaloupe soup. Next week, chanterelles. Make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Earth Eats where you get your podcasts. Our great team of workers at Earth Eats includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and the wonderful folks at Harvest Public Media. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in.